Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Iran is a possible nuclear threat in a full-scale news conference at the White House today. The president was asked repeatedly about the lack of progress in Iraq, and he admitted to difficulties.
Sometimes I'm frustrated, rarely surprised. Sometimes I'm happy. You know, But wars are not a time of joy. These aren't joyous times. These are challenging times. And they're difficult times. And they're straining the psyche of our country. I understand that.
Linda Feldman covered the news conference for the Christian Science Monitor, and she joins us on the line from Washington. And Linda, how significant was it that the president admitted that he's been frustrated by the war?
Well, it sort of closes the loop on the comment that Tony Snow had made last week. This was a reference to a New York Times article with someone quoted on background saying that they sensed a frustration from the president on the lack of progress on the bigger picture in Iraq, and Tony Snow denied that the president was frustrated. And I don't think anybody really believed that. So now we have the president himself admitting that sometimes I'm frustrated. I guess it just proves that he's a normal human being.
Mm. And what did he say about the specific situation in Iraq right now?
Well, he said that, he became very animated when he talked about Iraq. He's adamant about not pulling out, and that if the U.S. were to pull out, it would turn Iraq into a safe haven for terrorists and extremists, and that even though the picture doesn't look good, we just have to stick it out because the alternative would be worse.
Mm-hmm. He also, the overall theme today was one that we've heard many times before. That's the so-called freedom agenda, spreading democracy in the Middle East, and the president said that was a fundamental challenge of the 21st century. What does that mean?
Well, this is what he's really talking about is his fundamental outlook. It will be, I think, the fundamental legacy of his presidency, which is this, I guess, Wilsonian vision of what he would like to see in the Middle East. They have begun to talk a lot about the false stability that we had in the Middle East, which ended up producing 9/11. And so they're saying stability isn't necessarily a good thing. We have a lot of instability right now, which they're not happy about. But they're trying to get people to stand back and say, it looks bad now, but this is better than having airplanes flying into American skyscrapers.
Hmm. And he did speak about southern Lebanon and the need for an international peacekeeping force. What did he say?
Well, he said that that the United States is going to play its part. Of course, the U.S. doesn't plan to contribute troops itself, but the U.S. is going to provide logistical support, command and control assistance, and intelligence. And the U.S. also plans to contribute $230 million to help the people rebuild and return home.
Mm-hmm. There are also concerns that the president expressed about Iran's involvement in southern Lebanon. Let's hear what the president had to say.
Iran is obviously part of the problem. They sponsor Hezbollah. They encourage a radical brand of Islam. Imagine how difficult this issue would be if Iran had a nuclear weapon.
Now, these comments, Linda, came as Iran today turned away U.N. inspectors who were sent to examine their nuclear facilities. How high a priority is this for President Bush, or did it seem based on his news conference today?
Well, it is a very high priority. Of course, we already know how the Iranians feel about the August 31st deadline for suspending uranium enrichment, but the president opted not to give the official American response yet. He's waiting for Tehran to give its response. But, the bottom line is that it doesn't look good, that it looks like we're going to move to the next step with some kind of sanctions out of the U.N.
Mm-hmm. As we said at the beginning of this, the president was very jovial at times during this news conference. He had some fun with Cox News Service reporter Ken Herman, who was wearing a seersucker suit. And at the end of the news conference, reporters wanted to know when their usual space at the White House was going to be ready because it's being renovated right now. Let's listen to that exchange.
Are we coming back?
Absolutely, you're coming back.
Can we hold you?
Coming back to the bosom of the White House. I'm looking forward to hugging you when you come back, everybody.
So there was an awful lot of joviality. What do we take from the president's mood here?
Well, it was a fascinating press conference because he really went through the range of emotions. He can be very funny. I mean, he spent the whole time ribbing Ken Herman about his seersucker suit. He was very intense when he talked about Iraq and the Middle East. And then, you know, he has a certain rapport with certain journalists. April Ryan of American Urban Radio Network was the one who asked about, well, are we going to get to go back? And he and April have had this thing. They kind of like to rib each other. There's a lot of banter going on. She's African American, and I think he likes to call on her because they have that certain, relationship. You know, they sort of enjoy ribbing each other.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Linda, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you.
Linda Feldman is White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. The man accused of murdering John Benet Ramsey is now in California awaiting an extradition hearing. John Mark Carr was arrested last week in Thailand, where he worked as a teacher. It's unclear how Carr may have known Ramsey, a six-year-old beauty pageant princess who was found strangled in her family's home in Boulder, Colorado, almost 10 years ago. The 41-year-old Carr is an American and a fugitive from charges of possessing child pornography. He also allegedly had a fascination with the Ramsey case and courted children on the internet. A two-part series concluding in the New York Times today takes readers deep into the world of child pornography on the internet. And the reporter who wrote this series, Kurt Eichenwald, is on the line with us now. Kurt, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You say in your series that this was a result of a four-month investigation by the New York Times to learn about the online world of pedophiles. Were you surprised by the extent of this online community?
Well, not really. Actually, this started about a year and 2 months ago when I first ventured into this world and came up with a story about the webcam pornography industry that ran in December. What I had seen during that reporting was the nature of the conversations that take place on the internet among the pedophiles, and realized that this in and of itself was a worthwhile story. But I wanted to be sure that I spent enough time basically watching their conversations that what I would present would be a representative sample. And so I spent the 4 months after that story just watching their conversations and copying and pasting them into files so that I had them later on. And once it became very, very repetitive and I was hearing the same things over and over again, I felt like, okay, I've seen this world. I know what there is.
Hundreds and hundreds of sites, yes. How easy are they to find?
The conversation sites are very easy to find. If you're looking for them, you'll find them. And I intentionally did not name them in the article because I don't want to make it easier for people to find them.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a problem with them. Even though they like to hold themselves out as support groups, what they really are is rationalization groups. They spend a lot of time justifying child pornography. They spend a lot of time justifying molestation of children. And they draw these lines about, well, if there's force involved, it's bad, but if there's no force, it's okay.
And just explain it for a minute. If there's no force, it's okay. Why?
Because they view children as small adults. They view children as being tormented by parents and other adults who are robbing them of their rights to engage in sex with older men. I mean, it is a delusional fantasy world that there are these children wandering around looking for 45-year-old men with pot bellies that they can have sexual contact with.
You wrote about a young girl, maybe about 9 years old. Her online name, Sparkle. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that and what the online community around this girl is?
In the course of the conversations, there was a point where somebody mentioned model sites. I didn't know what they meant, but they put up a link. And I clicked on the link and found myself in really a world of nightmares. These were little girls, as young as 1 year old. Sparkle was nine. And these were children who were dressed in extremely thin thongs, tops that were soaked with water, panties that were two or three sizes too small, posing with their legs open, you know, in bathtubs, lifting out of the tub in unnatural ways, and with 6,000 men paying $30 a month to view these images. And the images, new ones, are taken every week and posted on Fridays. Now, when I found this, I know what the law is on child pornography, and the mere presence of clothing does not create an absolute rule against it being child pornography. It struck me as being seriously exploitative and almost certainly illegal.
But the operators of the site may have felt that the some clothing may have at least covered them legally, if you will.
Well, they can only do that if they have not bothered to read the law. And these guys spent a lot of time talking about the law. There is a case that I talk about in the story, U.S. v. Knox, which has established that if children in clothing can. And again, when we're talking about clothing here, we're not talking about street clothes. We're talking about thin lines of about half an inch wide that is designed not to cover up, but simply to allow them to say it's legal. And these just totally sparse pieces of clothing. They'll then say, well, that's not a problem. But U.S. v. Knox makes it very clear that it is a problem, and it can be a problem. And the issue is if there is what is called a lascivious exhibition of the genitals, in which, and in these cases, it certainly fit the descriptions under U.S. v. Knox. Also, you had marketing that was stomach-turning. I mean, you had a six or seven-year-old girl who they called Peach, and they said, you know, a peach has never tasted so delicious in heavy syrup. You had a girl named Lolly, which is a shorthand online among the pedophiles for Lolita, which is their favorite book. And Lolly was... their thing, what do you feel when Lolly looks at you in that way? Join her little Wonderland. Well, Wonderland happens to be, I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, it happens to be the name of the largest child porn group of all time.
And, Kurt, we're just going to have to interrupt you. We have to take a quick break. We're speaking with New York Times reporter Kurt Eichenwald. His two-part series on child pornography on the Internet concludes in the newspaper today. Just ahead, how are pedophiles using the website to offer advice to one another? Our conversation with Kurt Eichenwald continues. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. Some graphic descriptions about the online world of child pornography. We're back to Kurt now. And Kurt, before the break, you explained some of these so-called model sites involving very young children and how they're displayed online. I'm wondering, there's obviously an adult involved in exploiting some of these children. Are authorities going after these adults?
It's funny, the very first case pertaining to the model sites started popping this year, and it involved a woman who was posting images of her own daughter online, and she was doing it in conjunction with, I believe, three other men, one of them being the girl's stepfather. And the other two men were web hosts, and they had a very rather extensive business going of multiple model sites. It's an enormously profitable business. I mean, I mentioned Playtoy Enterprises in my story, and Playtoy opened up in October of last year, And by July, they had 6,000 members paying $30 a month to look at these images of these little girls. And you know, it was you can't make money. You can't sell drugs and make money that fast. And the whole element of it is when they argue, you know, Playboy in particular argued 100% legal, but the efforts they went to hide their identities, to make sure that nobody could find out who they were, was pretty extensive.
There are other sites that you talk about in the series, basically support sites for pedophiles as well, tips for pedophiles and how they can get near children. I'm wondering, in those sites, can you talk about what the sort of, if there is such a thing, average profile of the pedophile who was on these sites, who that person was? I know in one case you said that the most common occupation for most of these pedophiles was teacher.
In terms of what I saw, I can't tell you what the actual world reflects. Of the ones who spoke and the ones I saw in a variety of different rooms, whenever they disclosed their profession, most frequently it was teacher. But these are teachers and doctors and lawyers and, you know, DJs and unemployed guys and people working at fast food restaurants. It was just a cross section of America, and the sites themselves, the conversations themselves, at some point I think they were originally intended to be a support network for people who are struggling with, you know, a pretty isolating attraction. But what they have evolved into is really a system of self-rationalization and self-justification.
You also, in your story, write of one man who talks about a consensual sexual relationship with his 10-year-old daughter.
Yes. And how the being on the sites and reading everyone's explanations about why this is okay has allowed him to not feel guilty about it.
Now, you say the ones you spoke with and the ones you saw, did these any of these people know that you were a reporter and that you were doing this for a story? How did that work?
I never spoke to anybody. This was effectively, you know, walking into Grand Central Station and listening to everybody's conversations. These are open sites. I never entered a password. And these folks would just have conversations with each other, both in chat rooms and in bulletin board forums. And I would just observe. And so it's really, in a way, it's like going into the jungle and watching the leopards. I mean, you're trying very hard not to influence the direction. I never wanted to say anything because, truthfully, I'm not a real function of that world, and anything I would say would send it in a direction that it wouldn't naturally go. So I just wanted to see what they did and what they said.
Can you describe the booklet that you write about in your series that's written by pedophiles for boys, and it's circulated in areas frequented by young boys?
This was something that one day someone just posted this booklet, and there was an entire website set up that allowed you to download it in different formats along with instructions. It was a booklet called Straight Talk for Boys. And it was intended to be easily printed out. I printed it out, put it together, and I looked at this 18-page booklet, which basically was a treatise on how boys having sex with older men is a fine and wonderful experience, but make sure you don't tell anybody. And it was basically an entire effort to encourage kids to think there's nothing wrong with this. In fact, this is a loving, healthy relationship, but don't say anything. and the pedophiles, there were instructions that went with it, telling the pedophiles, you know, make sure you put this in a place where lots of kids gather, but don't make it don't leave it out too far so that adults won't find it too fast and throw them away, and make sure nobody sees you putting them out. I mean, it was a very involved series of instructions on how to surreptitiously manipulate children.
Are you a father?
I am.
You are. So for many of us, it was difficult to read some of the things that are happening online and how these children are attracted and whatnot. Was it difficult for you?
My torment came last year when I first started in this. And for quite a number of months, I couldn't take my kids to the mall without being, you know, right on top of them at all times. I couldn't, I would go to the sporting events and constantly be looking around about, you know, who is there, because a lot of the times what they're doing, they're trafficking in pictures of kids playing on their weekend games. And now I've gotten a handle on it. I'm much more in control of it. I know this stuff is horrifying, but I also know that if people don't know what's out there, then kids will be in danger.
All right, Kurt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kurt Eichenwald is a reporter for The New York Times. For more on his series about the online world of pedophiles, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide.
Emma Berman supported the war and lost the Democratic primary this month to anti-war candidate Ned Lamont. Lieberman is now mounting an independent campaign to try to hold on to his seat, and the race is generating a lot of talk and a lot of attention. Today, President Bush was asked if he would campaign in Connecticut against Lieberman, even though the Democratic senator supports the president's policy in Iraq, and the president said he's staying out of this one.
By the way, I'm staying out of Connecticut because, that's what the party suggested, the Republican Party of Connecticut. And plus, there's a better place to spend our money, time, and resources.
While the president may sit on the sidelines, others are not. Yesterday on ABC's This Week, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry blasted Lieberman for staying in the race. He says the Connecticut Democrat has adopted the rhetoric of Vice President Dick Cheney. Lieberman, on another Sunday talk show, responded and said he's still a Democrat and Kerry's just positioning himself for another shot at the White House. Well, David Lightman is Washington Bureau Chief for the Hartford Courant, and he's on the line with us now. Hello, David, and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, a new poll in Connecticut gives Lieberman an 11-point edge over Lamont in a three-way race, and you've said that he's trying to distance himself from the president over the war in Iraq. Lieberman is saying that while he did support the war, he has been critical of how the war has been fought. But does he need to separate himself from Bush here, David?
He needs to be very careful about how he plays this. Yes, on the one hand, he needs to separate himself. He needs to point out these differences, but not go too far and look like he's making an 11th-hour conversion. And that's a very delicate game.
And the White House is not formally supporting the Republican candidate, Alan Schlesinger, right?
No. The clip you played from the press conference today, in fact, it's already a story on the Internet, and it'll be a story in tomorrow's paper. Very interesting there, reading between the lines. The president is saying that he's staying out of Connecticut. Here he had a chance to say, I support the Republican nominee. He didn't do that. And then if you look at the text of the press conference, you'll see where the president went on and on defending Senator Lieberman's position on Iraq.
And so what's going on, do you think?
I think the president would like to see Joe Lieberman win. Bill Frist, the majority leader of the Senate, suggested he would ask the Senator Lieberman to caucus with the Republicans should he win. Lieberman's ruled that out. But look, the president's number one priority is Iraq and the war on terror, and he knows that Joe Lieberman is a reliable ally. Yes, he may vote with Democrats 90% of the time, but on these important issues of paramount importance to the president, he's with the president, and Mr. Bush wants him in his corner.
Let's talk about Ned Lamont then for a minute. He said that the war in Iraq is a major part of his campaign. And then you have this latest poll. What do you think that Lamont would have to do to appeal to Connecticut voters?
Well, I think Lamont has to move more towards the middle. What he can't do is have himself portrayed as a one-note candidate and a candidate of the left. And he's got to show that he has more breadth. He has to show that he has solid positions on all kinds of issues, health care, jobs, and so on and so forth, which he does. but he's got to get that message out. He needs to capture that 8-9% in the middle that he needs to win the election.
And how do you think he would go about doing that, especially when we have some prominent Democrats like Senator Kerry and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, all endorsing Lamont?
It's a big problem for Lamont because he has been identified. Again, this is one-note candidate, and Lieberman is going to just keep pushing him into that corner. One of the things you hear all over Connecticut is that Lamont has made some missteps there. For example, on election night, when he declared victory, there was Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Al Sharpton standing behind him. Well, that's fine. They were supporters. They were important to his victory. But he's got to move away from what's perceived as a Democratic left. So Lieberman's going to keep pushing that.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of the criticism from Senator John Kerry and the back and forth between he and Senator Lieberman?
You know, it's interesting because in 2004, when they were both running for president, there was tension between the two. Kerry at the time was not quite as anti-war as he is now, but Lieberman certainly was pro-war. And there was a coldness there. When Lieberman finally did endorse Kerry sometime in 2004, it was a very, I don't want to say tepid endorsement, but it was one of these things that happened, and it wasn't with great enthusiasm. And Lieberman went out there and campaigned a little bit for the ticket, but there's been a distance between the two of them. The distance was obvious on the Senate floor back in June. Kerry had his resolution to withdraw troops within a year. Lieberman was one of six Democrats who voted not only against Kerry's resolution, but against the softer resolution calling for phased deployment by the end of the year. So doesn't surprise me.
Right. And Vice President Cheney and Lieberman also have a past political history. That's interesting to note here.
It is. They were opponents, of course, in 2000. They had a polite debate. Although at the time of that debate in 2000, which was down in Kentucky, I believe it's Center College in Kentucky, and it was seen as a respectable debate with sharp differences. And years later, it became, gee, the two of them were too nice to each other. Lieberman didn't go after him enough. I don't know. But it's interesting now that Cheney's offering praise for Lieberman.
Right. Now Cheney is saying Lieberman's loss would be a loss in the Senate, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. The kind of Democrat we need. They sent out an email list 2 weeks ago and then did an interview with wire service reporters offering nothing but praise for Senator Lieberman.
So what do you think this race says overall about what's happening in the Democratic Party? Is there a message here?
I think so, and I'm hedging a little bit because we have to see how this plays out in November. The easy analysis right now is you have sort of two and a half factions in the party. One just wants this war over, period. They want troops out, the sooner the better. Another faction, if you will, sort of the Carl Levin, Jack Reed group, wants this phased deployment. They realize you can't just say, we'll pull troops out by X date. They want at least to see progress. They want benchmarks. The third sort of half group, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Mark Pryor of Arkansas, Joe Lieberman, and it's a small group, sort of supports the president's approach, and that is let's get a political solution as well as a military solution. Let's get people talking. Let's have an international conference. Let's work this out diplomatically. And that group, frankly, is not ascendant in the Democratic Party.
Hmm. And briefly then, David, how do you think this whole, how significant is this race in the overall battle for control of the Senate?
Well, I mean, the Connecticut seat's going to be Democratic no matter who wins. Either one's going to caucus with the Democrats. So I don't see this as one of the, as crucial as, say, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and some of these other races, because it's going to stay in Democratic hands.
All right. Well, David, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Lightman is Washington Bureau Chief for the Hartford Courant. Stay with us. There's more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Why is the sky blue? Well, if you've ever been stumped by that question, apparently you're not alone. Plato and Aristotle were puzzled by it, as was Leonardo da Vinci, and don't feel bad, even Newton and Einstein couldn't answer it. Well, here to help us get it right is physicist Peter Pesek. He's a tutor and musician in residence at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He explores the subject in his new book called Sky in a Bottle. Peter, welcome.
Thanks very much, Deborah.
Well, let's keep the suspense going for a little while here. Take us on the journey that you took with this question. What are some of the interesting wrong answers you found to the question, why is the sky blue?
Well, mainly people thought that there had to be something in the air causing it. People thought, well, maybe there's dust suspended in the air. That's what the Arab philosophers thought. Newton thought it was little droplets of water because he experimented with them and saw some nice blue colors. Other people thought it was bubbles, but all of them were problematic because the bubbles and the droplets wouldn't last. And sometimes we see very clear and beautiful blues on dry days when there seems to be nothing in the air at all.
Hmm. So you, in all of this, have found out a lot about the color blue and how we perceive it. What are some of the more interesting things, would you say, that you found out about this?
Well, although blue now is the most popular color in the whole world, according to surveys, that hasn't always been the case. In antiquity, blue was regarded in many places, in the West at least, as kind of an ill-omened color, perhaps because people turned blue after death. It was a color of mourning in Greece and Rome, or associated with barbarians. In the Quran, the devils have blue eyes, although in the East it's different. Often in India, the gods are depicted as being blue. But the color has very, very different associations, and about 1200 or so, suddenly in the West, the great vogue for blue began. Virgin Mary started to be depicted with blue robes, and the sky started to be painted blue rather than gold color in paintings.
So do we need a drum roll here, Peter? I mean, why is the sky blue?
Well, we don't fully understand, but the most important element in the answer seems to be because molecules and atoms are physically real. If they weren't physically real in the sense of existing as objects in space that can scatter or interact with light, we wouldn't see any color in the sky at all or any kind of brightness. The sky would be as black as the pictures you see in outer space. So that's the central and surprising reason. Surprising because for a long time, people thought that atoms were a kind of model or explanation, a theoretical model, but they didn't think that atoms really physically were there.
So they were sort of on the right track, thinking initially that maybe it was something in the air, but yeah, they got it wrong because of not believing in the existence of atoms.
That's right. Yeah, they thought that the air itself had to be empty. They couldn't believe, in a certain sense, that there were really things there that could scatter the way they thought the dust or the bubbles could.
What about the role of the eye in perceiving color?
Yes, that turned out to be something that was more surprising, and it surprised me in the course of writing the book. Because, of course, the sky looks blue to us because we name the colors, and if the sky isn't blue, what is? But if you take a measuring instrument, not the eye, that's capable of measuring the different colors in the sky, like a spectrophotometer, it will say that the sky is violet. The reason seems to be that we don't perceive a violet sky is that our eye is very insensitive to violet colors of light. And so the eye takes all the different colors that come in all over the whole visible spectrum and from them makes the color that we call blue.
So the simple answer, if a child says, why is the sky blue? Have we confused them even more here, or do we have a simple answer for them?
Because there are atoms and molecules in the sky, and they are able to tell the difference between blue and red light, and they scatter blue light more than red. And so the light we see scattered away from the sun is blue because of that reason. That's the simple reason, but the deeper reason, I don't think in a sense we really know, because it would require us to understand how the eye works, how the eye processes color, and that's very mysterious and still not understood, I think.
All right. Well, Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you, Deborah.
Physicist Peter Pesek is a tutor and musician in residence at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico. His new book is titled Sky in a Bottle. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Love my way. Yeah.
the highest number since the war began. And the president repeated his pledge to stay the course.
Either you say, yes, it's important we stay there and get it done, or we leave. We're not leaving so long as I'm the president. That would be a huge mistake. It would send an unbelievably, you know, terrible signal to reformers across the region. It would say we've abandoned our desire to change the conditions that create terror. It would give the terrorists a safe haven from which to launch attacks. It would embolden Iran. It would embolden extremists. No, we're not leaving. The strategic objective is to help this government succeed.
Well, in the early days of the war in Iraq, two young men headed to Baghdad from Boston, giving up a successful franchise selling T-shirts outside Red Sox games. After gambling and drinking away much of the thousands of dollars they made selling the T-shirts and finding themselves at the end of another baseball season in 2003, Jeff Newman and Ray Lemoyne decided they wanted to do something else, something, as they describe it, more relevant. So they went to Iraq and worked for the U.S. government in Baghdad for 4 months, something they now say they regret. Jeff and Ray join us in the studio to talk about their book, Babylon by Bus. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's first look at your unabridged title of your book. It says, Babylon by Bus, the true story of two friends who gave up their valuable franchise selling Yankee Suck T-shirts at Fenway to find meaning and adventure in Iraq, where they became employed by the occupation and jobs for which they lacked qualification and witnessed much that amazed and disturbed them. That's it in a nutshell?
That sums it up pretty well. we had both kind of come to the end of our ropes. That had been our livelihood until 2003, and all of a sudden it was over in the fall, and we were looking at pretty bleak futures. So we decided we wanted to go to the Middle East. We felt like it was our right to see what our country was doing over there.
Just to go, though, with no real plan.
No real plan. Plans are overrated.
Yeah, most of the time we just, you know, like we say over and over, we're both suckers for bad schemes.
It turned out that the time we were there was actually the safest point in the Iraq war. So, and then we got jobs right away.
Yeah, we got jobs, you know, pretty much the first day we were there with the coalition.
Yeah.
For jobs for which you say you had no qualifications.
We had zero qualifications.
No, but nobody was qualified.
Yeah. They were
only
so
the
understaffed.
Top tier of people had any experience in the Middle East or in nation building. So for like, you know, to fill like a lowly position like NGO, you know, coordinator, and they needed anybody they could.
But what was your job basically? You were hired to do what?
To coordinate Iraqi NGOs.
You know, we were basically interns for this lady Heather Coyne.
It was all very new to them. They had never had any non-governmental organizations or anything in the country. So now there were hundreds of them starting up, and we kind of served as the interface between the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, and everyday Iraqis. So we held a weekly meeting at the convention center in Baghdad in the Green Zone, and you know, anywhere from 200 to 400 people would show up, and
it was the biggest meeting for Iraqi citizens inside the Green Zone.
It's like a town hall style meeting.
It was pretty much the only large scale meeting that the Americans were hosting, so that Iraqis could come meet their occupier. And we ran that meeting. We were the NGO liaisons between.
Now, Ray, you said intern, so that suggests no money.
We volunteered.
Yeah,
we wouldn't
paid
take their
anything.
Money.
So how did you make a living then? How did you earn money?
A couple of weeks in, Heather Coyne got us badges, the CPA badge, which gave us privileges to eat the buffet.
It's like a meal plan.
It's like a meal plan, yeah, exactly. We slept in the main Republican Palace. The only thing we'd spend money on was if we went out at night, but a lot of times, you know, people would buy us drinks or buy us dinner if we went out with them.
Journalists would especially pick up the bill for us because we gave them a lot of good information.
Yeah.
A lot of the worst.
We'd show them around the Green Zone a lot. And
yeah, we were the loosest-lipped people, I think. And
yeah.
But so you had access to this information. Jeff, I just want you to explain that a little bit. I mean, you went in. I'm presuming no background checks, really. You're hired for these jobs that you agreed to volunteer for. You're suddenly in the Green Zone, staying in a palace, on the meal plan, and you have access to information that you can give to journalists who will buy you dinner.
At the Coalition Press Center upstairs, they held a daily news briefing kind of thing, just like the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon, you know? So afterwards, they'd all come down to our office and kind of get the filter-free version of what had gone on upstairs.
And they would use our computers because we had free internet. We called it our freelancer internet cafe.
Yeah. And we shared an office with the detainees issues. arm of the CPA, which dealt with Abu Ghraib. And so Iraqi families would come in, you know, crying and looking for missing or harmed relatives, which was the other half of our office, separated just by a cubicle.
Now, I'm wondering if before you went in and after you actually lived there, if it changed your opinion considerably about the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq.
Of course.
Tell me how. When you went, what did you think?
Well, when we went, before we got to the country, you know, we were both against the war, but at the same time, we wanted to do what we could to help. So when we got there, we just saw how poorly the whole thing was run.
Like, why? Why was
it criminal?
Offensive? Like, tell me stands out in your head as being something that you thought was
probably the worst thing they were doing is killing. The rules of engagement were questionable, and they were killing civilians. That's probably the top murder would probably be the top crime. It would be mass murder. The second crime would probably be torture. Then the third crime would probably be rape, and then the fourth crime would probably be corruption. And then It goes down. Give me a list of crimes, and we could find every single one of them and the Americans did it.
And you witnessed all of this.
We didn't witness murders, but we heard about it. We were there when it was happening. We knew journalists who were driving up to a checkpoint who got shot and their heads blown off. Like, we knew the people who got killed. Yeah. And, you know, this stuff was happening, and, like, while we were there, and we saw that firsthand. And Abu Ghraib happened right after we left.
Yeah.
We thought we were helping. We ended up getting people killed, which I think is, like, the big...
Well, explain that to me.
We built a program, a civil society building program. It was a network of NGOs, and we passed it on to an Iraqi gentleman by the name of Haider. And we were told that they had targeted us for assassination, and so we left the country. An American diplomat gave us money to fly out, and, you know, we thought it was just played up. Like, they always play up security threats. And then, like, a month and a half later, the guy who took over our program was murdered. So... You know, I mean, what did we accomplish besides getting people who came into contact with us killed? Not very much.
You know, we gave out a sense of false hope in a way, you know. Like, we would go out on distribution runs with, mostly it was donated clothing or school supplies, stuff like that. And in the big picture, it's like, you know, what good are a couple of thrift store shirts to a kid when they don't have running water or there's raw sewage running down the hallways of their schools?
Or just by taking those shirts, they could get killed.
Yeah, and we're sitting there saying in these meetings, things are going to get better, things are going to get better, trust us, things are going to get better, and nothing ever got better. So, you know, I think we did more harm than good.
You know, these are terrible stories now told by two people who not very long ago were selling T-shirts outside Fenway Park. Now, if somebody came to you and said, I'd like to change my life around that drastically and go from there to Iraq... You tell them they were crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, with the current situation. We've been running into people that we worked with at the CPA lately, and all of them, you know, they're just scratching their heads. They're like, how do you get anything done in that country? You can't.
We had so much trouble back then getting anything done.
Yeah, and now it's like they're all like just living in this little, you know, this little bubble, the green zone. It's the size of Central Park, and they can't leave. And you can't really get any real work done.
Even if I could go back in time and somehow send a message to myself, I'd tell myself that was a bad idea to go to Baghdad.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to both
of
you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Jeff Newman and Ray Lemoine are authors of the new book, Babylon by Bus. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Israel debates what went wrong in Lebanon and what's next for the Jewish state. Also, the U.S. is trying to catch terrorists by reading faces.